This is Wallace Kleindienst, your volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and welcome to this edition of Rolling Stone. We read from the December 2025 edition of Rolling Stone magazine, and we start with Random Notes. Roll with it. The Joy of Oasis' Reunion Tour. This year's widely successful show marks a moment of reconciliation for the Gallagher brothers and brought out the best in lots of dudes. Jeff Jarrett traveled from his home in St. Louis to see the kickoff of the Oasis Live 25 tour in Cardiff, Wales in July, then to Chicago's Soldier Field in August. But for him, no Oasis gig will ever match the early September night in Pasadena, California, where Jarrett saw his favorite band alongside his six-year-old son, Woof, for the first time. He says, "It was an evening that was as lovely and as loud as I hoped it would be." Jarrett, age 44, a booking agent and artist manager who proudly recalls watching his son receive fist bumps and high fives from those seated around them. He says, "When Woof was singing Acquiesce, I laughed like Mr. Burns in The Simpsons, My Son Loves Oasis. The plan is working. Fathers and sons, dads and daughters, dads and their dads, husbands, boyfriends, best buddies, former college roommates, current college roommates, and none of them behave badly, at least not from what I observed over Labor Day weekend at the first of two MetLife Stadium shows in New Jersey. Dare I say I was impressed, moved, and yes, surprised by all of the positive masculinity. Seemingly everywhere I went, there were happy, sensitive, emotional, and chivalrous men. At the merchandise stand, at the tequila bar, even in the parking lot, where one jovial gentleman was handing out beers to passerbys and inviting them to watch Sunday football on the big screen TV he had positioned on a folding table. So much hugging, kissing, weeping among dudes, and not one bro tussle in the three shows I've been to." Bob Ferguson, a New Jersey Gen Xer who heads up musician outreach for Oxfam, texted me after the Labor Day show at MetLife. He also caught the two reunion shows in Toronto, Oasis's first stop on this tour in North America. "I've never seen so many solo dads with kids at a rock show singing together like it's the most natural family outing to be on the floor of a football stadium shouting out, 'I'm a rock and roll star.' I love that unlikely lads of Oasis might be causing some amazing social civility." Civility was never the Brothers Gallagher's strong suit. Rudeness was their reputation, and in the 90s and 2000s, it was on full display in interviews where they'd walk out mid-conversation, say something offensive, or mock the journalists, and at their own concerts where Liam was known to spit beer at the audience. Older brother Noel was fond of throwing barbs at fellow musicians. Phil Collins was a middle-of-the-road baldy. Robin Williams, the fat dancer from Take That, and on and on. When INXS frontman Michael Hutchinson presented Oasis a Brit Award in 1996, Noel started his acceptance speech with, "Has-beens shouldn't be presenting awards." The Gallaghers infamously and very publicly insulted each other too. After the band broke up in 2009, Liam spent years poking Noel on Twitter, labeling him a potato and a sad little dwarf, while Noel described Liam as the angriest man you'll ever meet. "He's like a man with a fork in a world of soup." Now, 16 years after Noel ended Oasis in Paris, reportedly following a physical altercation backstage, during which Liam wielded a guitar like an axe, the brothers made a point of starting each other's show by walking out on stage with their arms around each other. Hugs and kisses abound. Does time heal old wounds and soften even the hardest and naughtiest of rock stars? Some might say staging a comeback tour that stands to pull in a reported $1.6 billion helps. But Paul Adams, age 54, born and raised in Manchester, England, just like Noel and Liam, offers a little armchair psychology on the dynamic between the Gallagher brothers. You have to understand, Northern men are about as passionate as they come, he says. When you fall out with somebody in the north of England, it becomes part of your identity. It's the clothes that you wear, but it's all bravado. The second their audience was removed, both of those men were filled with regret at this relationship that had seemingly ended, to the point where they probably don't even remember why. But there was always a longing for reconciliation. So we can be cynical about the brothers coming out arm in arm, but actually, they need it. Jason Singer, also known as Nashville-based singer-songwriter Mr. Anunder, who points to Oasis as one of the reasons I make music, thinks their fans need the reconciling too. Singer says, these shows are taking people back to a time when we weren't so polarized as a society. Singer, who's age 33, saw one of the Chicago shows. At my seat at MetLife Stadium, I met the acquaintance of those around me. They included two lifelong mates who generally ignored the band on stage in favor of singing nearly every lyric to each other. Nearby was a guy who was there with his fiancée and her parents. He'd specially chosen this night, this concert, for his first meeting with his future in-laws. To my right were two brothers from the Bronx, Frank, age 34, and Joseph, age 27. I met the former when he asked if we could link arms to do the Ponzinari, a fan favorite moment during Cigarettes and Alcohol, when Liam asked the audience to turn their backs to the stage and jump up and down. As with many of the fans I met that night, this wasn't their first Oasis concert. Frank, a construction tradesman like his brother, said he had never been overseas before. But when the announcement came that the group was reuniting and beginning the tour in the UK, Joseph texted me like crazy, "We have to go." When we were kids, my brother got into them because I was into them. Their music brought us a lot closer. Their brothers were brothers. When tickets went on sale for the UK dates, the two stayed up all night in New York and eventually scored a pair for one of the seven sold-out London dates at Wembley Stadium. The lights go down and the first notes of the intro hit, and I'm arm in arm with my brother taking it all in, says Frank. I look around and everyone's feeling the same sentiment, togetherness, community. Then they come on, Liam and Noel holding hands. I just lost it. I mean tears. I cried like four times, Singer says, recalling his experience at the Soldier Field show. It was the best night of my life. I've gotten to see some crazy cool shows, but this topped it. I generally cannot stop thinking about it. I've never experienced anything like it. I've seen a lot of people saying, this is the Eras tour for white dudes. I don't know how anyone could go about replicating it. Impossible, sniffs Adams. There's nobody that can now reform that's ever going to beat it. It's working class music, underpinned with ambition and seeing beauty in the ordinary. Noel's songs of hope, friendship, and joy, combined with his ability to write gorgeously sad chord progressions and hymns as sung by his brother, are needed now more than ever. Everything is shit, so go and drink a beer, hug the people around you, sing the songs you know like the back of your hand, and believe that it's all going to work out. We next turn to Sunrise and Sunset, Ethan Hawke, My Life in Seven Roles. The actor Ethan Hawke is earning Emmy and Oscar buzz with his two latest projects. Here are the big parts that honed his skills. He's been a shy prep student, a hopelessly romantic, an earnest LA cop, a priest in existential crisis, the embodiment of Gen X slackitude. Over 40 years, we've watched Ethan Hawke go from engineering to artist, a trend that continued this past fall with his turns as a batty citizen journalist in the Tulsa set series, The Lowdown, and broken down Broadway composer Lorenz Hart in Richard Linklater's Blue Moon movie. "I've been really lucky that I got to be mentored and nurtured," Hawke says of his career longevity. He reflects on his memorable movie roles. The Dead Poets Society in 1989, where he played Todd Anderson. "You know how you hear about people sailing around Cape Horn, like you've never done it before, but you heard it's been accomplished, right? Dead Poets Society was, for me, like making that trip. I wasn't the captain. I wasn't even the first mate. I was just on the boat. But I saw firsthand that it could be done and how a good ship is run." The movie Reality Bites in 1994. He played Troy Dyer. "I did that movie because of Winona Ryder. She was the best actor in the world at the moment. I resisted. Who wants to watch a movie about four whining white people, none of whom I like? And Winona Ryder went, 'We don't have to like them. Let's just play them truthfully.' So I said yes. Then everyone thought I was that asshole for years." The movie, The Before the Trilogy, 1995 to 2013, and the actor Jesse. "I learned how to talk on screen by doing that first movie. The thing about Jesse, he's not trying to impress Julie Delpy's character, Celine, when they met. He wants to connect. Rick Linklater, the director, was like, 'I've never seen a movie where it's all connect, connect, and connect.'" The movie Training Day, 2004, the actor, the role of Jake Hoyt. "Denzel Washington and I did the first read-through, and I thought, you know, just do an okay job at this. This guy wins the Oscar. Someone once said that my performance got a little lost with what Denzel is doing. My response is that it got lost the way that Scottie Pippen's performance got lost. I'm proud of what we did. It's like I'm playing with Michael Jordan." The movie Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, 2007, and the character he played, Hank Hansen. "If you aspire to be a New York actor, you want to work with Sidney Lumet, but it was not easy. Sidney was like a coach who's going to push you to your limits. One day he was really pushing Phil Seymour Hoffman, and Phil snapped. 'Did Al Pacino have to do this kind of shit?' Sidney replied, 'Yes, he did. And did you like the movies he did with me? You do? Great. Now we can get back to work.'" The movie First Reformed, 2017, and the character Reverend Ernst Toller. "With writer Paul Schrader, you clearly were in the presence of a major artist who had something big to say and was so grateful he had the chance to say it. There were times I was doing a scene and you hear something off to the side and it would be Paul crying. 'This was not a job to this person. This was a calling.'" And finally, the movie The Good Lord Bird, 2020, and the character John Brown. "This role felt like a dare, like the story of abolitionist John Brown as told by Red Fox. It was the most batshit crazy performance. I just took big, fat swings for the fences every time. Some speeches in that show I look at now and think, I'm out of my fucking mind here." And we end Random Notes on the short, What the Money is For. If you are a billionaire, why? No hate, but give your money away, shorties. Billie Eilish. While being honored by the WSJ magazine on October 29th, in part for donating $11.5 million in tour proceeds to charity, Billie Eilish, the musician, gave the uber-rich to do more. People need empathy and help more than ever. And we leave random notes to turn to reviews. Pop's top chaos agent hits a brilliant new peak. Confronting herself and communing with the eternal, Rosalía delivers a transcendent album with Lux. Given 5 stars, Lux, an album produced by Columbia, by Rosalía. Recently, while promoting a new album, Lux, Rosalía recorded a TikTok live that shows her in her car, tearing through the night-slick streets of Madrid, blasting Mozart's The Marriage of Figaro overture on her sound system while meeting fans on her way to the iconic and opulent Plaza del Callao. Normally, a moment like that would feel slight, mundane, and almost unremarkable. But somehow, those couple of seconds, a modern-day pop star at the wheel, roaring through frenzied intersections with one of the music's most lasting compositions backing her every move, capture the eternal ethos of her masterful new album, Lux. Let's be clear. Lux sounds like absolutely nothing else in music right now, and it's an album no other pop star could have made. Rosalía has been herself to be pop's most provocative chaos agent, having released radical projects like the 2018 El Mar Queer, which played with flamenco traditions and pop genres, and 2022's Motomami, an exploration of femininity through sharp-eyed production and reggaeton beats. Yet the album Lux feels like her most astonishing offering yet, packed with history and decades of training that led her tie classical sounds, opera references, and 14 different languages into one gorgeous gutting package that feels like a truly timeless work of art. The album succeeds because every song is deeply thought out and widely heartfelt, tying back to heady ideas of what the hell we're all doing here. She contends with pain and loss, anger and grief, sex and desire, love and worship, while trying to get a better understanding of who she is, the way she loves, and the spiritual forces that move her. From the second the album starts with the dramatic piano chords of the opener Sexo Violencia Lilantes, she's trying to find her place in the physical world and whatever realm comes after. She says how nice it will be to live between them both. First I'll love the world, then I'll love God. Lux is separated in 4 sections or movements as Rosalía sprints off, searching for herself and God in a chaotic world. Through the stunning string arrangement of Rilke, she contemplates all the things she's lost, her faith, her smile, a friend, traveling from country to country before realizing she's someone who loves fully despite whatever pain she's going through. On Foco Rani, she works through rage and broken promises. The song alludes to a called-off wedding, before declaring, I'll just belong to me and to my liberty. On La Perea, she tears down effigies, skewering a self-involved man, a national heartbreaker, emotional terrorist, and a world-class fuck-up, alongside the Musica Mexicana singer Yaritza. But the most moving moments are self-revelations, like on Divinities, easily the album's standout. Over dazzling strings and weighty production, she switches from Catalan to English, laying herself bare for others. Bruise me up, I'll eat all of my pride. I know that I was made to divinize. The closing scene is a somber picture as Rosalía imagines her own casket, adorned with magnolias. I come from the stars, but today I turn to dust to go back to them, she sings, a slight echo surrounding her voice like a halo. But then Lux has ended, leaving us in a transformative piece of expression that's as intense and maximalist as life itself. Next, we turn to the cover story, Mother Mayhem, Voices of the Year, Lady Gaga, how she returned from the brink, found love, and made one of her greatest albums. Every night on her current tour, at the moment she emerges on stage as Lady Gaga, perched atop a 14-foot-high crimson gown, Stephanie Giramata starts to panic. At the center of her opera house set, two layers of curtains part, revealing that glorious, preposterous, Clifford-sized crinoline and a tiny woman ensconced within. 20,000 or so now grown little monsters scream for the guiding light who told them when they needed it most that they were born this way. They still need it. High above the crowd, she's lightheaded, too aware of a pounding heart. As the dress glides forward and her band crashes into the evening's first chords, she braces herself against the adrenaline flood that once felt like her reason to live. "When I'm not on stage, I feel dead," she told me in our last encounter, 14 years and several mental health crises ago, before she'd ever seen a therapist. "Whether that is healthy or not is really of no concern to me," she says. She bagged back then of not sleeping or eating or living on coffee and music. She was dating on and off a surly metalhead bartender she considered her muse. Everyone around her called her Gaga. She was about to finish her second album, Born This Way, which went on to sell 14 million copies. It was easy at that point to envision the rest of her career as a clean-up arc, upward arc. Her next album was the Jagged Art Pop, which fans would eventually embrace as a favorite. But critics were hostile, sales slowed, and Gaga faced the first backlash of her career in an already fragile moment. She's been suppressing trauma since age 19, when, she said, a music producer raped her. In the art pop era, it was breaking through. She tried to escape it all and managed to record some of her biggest hits along the way. She made jazz albums with her friend Tony Bennett, nailing Lush Life, the Billy Strayhorn composition Frank Sinatra found too hard to sing. She veered into movie stardom, specializing in emotionally transparent performances that were difficult to reconcile with her layered music world persona. She knocked off a great soundtrack LP for the movie A Star Is Born, experimented with the off-kilter Americana-tinged Joanne, anything but a straight-up Lady Gaga pop album. Even as she played the Super Bowl halftime show and won 2 Golden Globes and an Oscar, her psychic was unraveling. "I did A Star Is Born on lithium," she offhandedly reveals. On the Joanne World Tour, right after shooting that film, she experienced what she described as a psychotic break. "There is one day that my sister said to me, 'I don't see my sister anymore,' she says, and I canceled the tour. There was one day I went to the hospital for psychiatric care. I needed to take a break. I couldn't do anything. I completely crashed. It was really scary. There was a time where I didn't think I could get better. I feel lucky to be alive. I know that might sound dramatic, but we know how this can go." Lady Gaga's made her way back with a lot of help from her fiancé, Michael Polanski, a kind, puppy-eyed, Harvard-educated entrepreneur who's never called her anything but Stephanie. "Being in love with someone that cares about the real me made a very big difference," she says. But that meant she had to figure out just who that was, How do you learn how to be yourself with someone when you don't know how to be yourself with anyone? She's found that answer and now considers herself a healthy, whole person. In March, she released Mayhem, one of the greatest albums of her career, reclaiming every bit of her musical gagitude in all of its multiplicities after all of her years of shying away from it. It was months and months and months of rediscovering everything that I lost, she says, and I honestly think that's why it's called Mayhem, because what it took to get back to was crazy. The accompanying tour, the Mayhem Ball, is the most impressive spectacle in a career full of them, but the first performances immediately confirmed how much she had changed. I'm not an adrenaline junkie anymore, she says. I used to love that feeling. Now she reacts like any well-balanced human would if they found themselves wheeled out in front of a packed arena, squeezed into a mammoth Lady Gaga costume. I see all the fans, she says, eyes wide, and I'm in this big dress, and the music is so loud, and it's very dramatic. And for 90 seconds, I have to talk myself out of a panic attack. Polanski, listening in on her mic feed, sometimes catches her breathing hard. The feeling sustains for the entire first song. I'm panicking a little bit during Bloody Mary. But after that comes this year's hit, Abracadabra, which may well have supplanted Bad Romance as a gaggiest song ever recorded. Its triumphant chorus replete with authentic mother monster gibberish. Abracadabra, morta ogo gaga, abracadabra, abra onana. Somehow, every time she starts that song's choreography, her heart rate slows and she remembers who she is. All of her practice for this tour, for every tour, kicks in. The rehearsal of self saves me, she says. Every cell in my body goes, you know what to do. Around that point, she tends to gaze out at the crowd and shout a familiar command. Put your fucking paws up. Yes, Stephanie. She's definitely not Gaga or Stephanie, Polanski says. She's both, and yeah, they go together much better than I think people realize. She put in a little differently. Lady Gaga's the person who made Lady Gaga, she says, permitting herself a small laugh at the tautology. I think I just feel more relaxed about it all, like I am Lady Gaga. You know, this idea that it has to be something specific, I think that's an old story I used to tell myself, and I don't really care what anyone calls it anymore. It's just me. Sometimes, though, it's not quite that simple. On a Tuesday afternoon in early July, 8 days before the start of the tour, three Lady Gagas stalk her opera house, currently installed in an empty Las Vegas arena. One Gaga is up in the giant red dress, silent and still waiting. Another in a leotard is trying out choreography near a catwalk that extends into the absent crowd. The third Gaga is on the arena floor, watching them from the darkness. The Gaga in the dress is one of the tour's dancers, named Jessica Tatoa, a petite blonde who looks a bit like the real thing. In the show's psychodrama, she portrays Gaga's dark side, mistress of mayhem, when Gaga isn't playing that part herself. The star of the show also sometimes embodies her light side. Mayhem's prey, a character she thinks of as ethereal Gaga. The Gaga in the leotard is another tour dancer named China Taylor, who's only gagging for the sake of rehearsals, so the real performer can watch herself from off stage. Gaga asserts, the show is created by the person that is in the audience. Let's get some more fog on the stage, says a real Gaga over the PA, speaking into a microphone in the gloom. In minimal makeup, she's dressed like her own stagehand, all in black, with a blonde ponytail sticking out of a knit cap. Torn fishnet stockings are the only stylistic flair she's allowed herself. All in all, it's the most Stephanie version of her I've met. And the same look tour audiences will see when she reemerges at the end of each show out of costume, her face scrubbed. Polonczyk calls this incarnation the artist. Today, she periodically consults with her fiancé, a calm presence in shorts, t-shirt, and running shoes, also all in black. She sees him as her key creative partner now, and he's credited alongside her as one of the tour's creative directors and executive producers. The stage smoke wafting through the air gets even heavier. Strobe light paints it in crimson. Doomy synth chords echo. Even more than the finished show, this eerie, perplexing, multi-gaga spectacle feels like a glimpse into her subconscious. She says later, "You're not wrong. It is this gothic dream, and it's somehow completely related to the inner romance that I have struggled with my whole life." Lady Gaga is bearing down on the task of the day, the reason why she's assembled her doubles on stage. At the last minute, she's adding a gut-renovated version of Shallow to the show, with staging that nods to Andrew Lloyd Webber's Phantom of the Opera. "Getting her to the B stage is always a question," says Michael Polonczyk, her fiancé, and they came up with a novel solution, a gondola. Her crew just needs to build her one and figure out how to propel it across the catwalk to her piano on the other side. They'll keep it simple, putting it on wheels and having dancers drag it across. "It's so campy to sing Shallow on a boat," Gaga says happily. "Sort of ridiculous. I was like, this is the perfect challenge, because this could be really bad." She also wanted to bring Shallow into her own aesthetic universe for the first time, since its studio arrangement so deeply reflected its cinematic origins. "It doesn't have my signature style," Gaga says. She happened to remember that Mark Ronson, one of its co-writers, created an electronic drum loop that didn't make the final recording. After she texted him, he dug it back up and sent it to her. The song now opens with throbbing synth bass that completely transforms its mood and style. I think what it brought out in the song is that Ally and Jackson's relationship was actually kind of dark, she says. "In this version, I get the feeling that something really scary might happen." You're tuned in to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and you're listening to Rolling Stone. And the feature story on Lady Gaga continues. "Come with me," Gaga says, and we journey through concrete corridors to her curtained-off, carpeted backstage sanctum. The decor is minimal, a big TV in a road case, a table set for a couple's dinner, framed pictures of her and Polonczyk's, a couple of coffee table books, a tongue-in-cheek Vanity Fair 100 years, and so forth. We settle into twin plus chairs, a pricey unlit candle, Santal 26 by Lilabo Fragrances, on the table between us. In previous meetings, Gaga was more comfortable having me tail her through her life than with the introspection of sit-down interviews. This time we land in heavy territory right away. She's off the deep end. Watch as she dives in. The concert's narrative, a dreamologic version of some of her real-life journey, allows her to do real character work, even improv, in the middle of a purported pop concert. "I've never acted in this way on an arena stage before," Gaga says, though to be fair, neither has anyone else. "It's different every night," she says. She cried after one night's show, explaining to Michael Polonczyk, her fiancé, that something new happened. "After I sang A Million Reasons to Mayhem, she was afraid of me." She attempts to succinctly break down the story. "Mayhem is how I start the show," she says. "It's the most egocentric side of me, a side of being Gaga that I really loathe. I basically announced that I'm the queen, and I put a more naive and youthful version of myself into a deep sleep, with a desire to torture her as a way of teaching her how to be great. Ethereal Gaga enjoys it. She just falls into this gothic mania, and Mayhem is aghast because her whole motivation was to teach this girl a lesson and sort of abuse her into greatness, and what she wanted doesn't go as planned. There is, of course, some not-so-veiled autobiography here. I think maybe people don't know how heavily I was worked as a young person, says Gaga, and a reminder of the time I watched her perform six songs after midnight for some random promotional video back in 2009. Her voice gave out, and she fled the room, only to return and force herself to the inconsequential performance with a level of inhumane determination that I found worrisome. Like her character, she had a habit of embracing the pain inflicted upon her. She says, "I believed in suffering for your art. I believed that in a way that was so real. It was almost earnest and sweet, but it was really not healthy for me." As she recorded Mayhem, Gaga had dreams of these different sides of herself. There's a line in the Industrial Confessional Perfect Celebrity about a clone asleep on the ceiling, and the disquieting single Disease was narrated by Gaga's dark side before she had a name for it. The lyrics were, "You're so tortured when you sleep, plagued with all your memories." Well, Gaga doesn't quite remember, and neither did I, until I went back to my transcripts, is that she was having similar versions as early as 2011. "I had this dream that I had something evil inside of me," she told me that year, as we rode through Manhattan in a chauffeured car. "And there was this white wall, and in order to get the negativity and the evil out of me, I had to hit the wall, and in essence would fly out of my soul center. I was trying to get rid of it, an exorcism of some sort." The exorcism clearly didn't stick back then. When it came time to make the video for Disease, Mayhem's first single, the Mayhem character was born. We started exploring with the choreography this idea of me battling myself, she says. "That song is so deliberately about somebody that wants to harm you, and it being you." Gaga has played with horror movie imagery before, but the Disease video is a coded tour of her darkest thoughts, a remarkably uncompromising way to begin an all-important album cycle. She starts the video singing as her own corpse, mowed down by a car with Mayhem at the wheel, and it gets more nightmarish from there. Oddly enough, the video and all the thematic cues the tour took from it might not have existed without Gaga's latest movie, last October's instantly notorious mega-flop, Joker Fala Adieu. "There was a ton of negativity around Joker," she says, "and I think I was feeling artistically rebellious at the time." Gaga's deeply felt turn alongside Joaquin Phoenix as a tragically delusional Harley Quinn won some of the film's only praise. Reviews were otherwise vicious. Fans of the 2019 dour Joker were outright repelled by the new film's daring, if not reckless, tonal leap. The original was a Fa Scorsi urban decay drama, and this was a surreal semi-musical about mental illness with a cartoon segment. After all of Gaga's experiences, did the wave of hatred for a movie really bother her? "I wasn't, like, unfazed," she says, smiling at my question. "It's funny, I'm almost nervous to share my reaction. But the truth is, when it first started happening, I started laughing, because it was just getting so unhinged." Her amusement eventually faded. When it takes a while for something to kind of dissipate, that can be a little more painful, only because I put a lot of myself into it, Gaga says. The disease video, then, was an answer to all that hostility. "I put so much of that energy into that video," Gaga says. "I was in that place, you know. I was like, I'll show you who I am, and I'll show you what this fight is like." The resulting work of art cut a little too deep. "When we were done filming it, I went kind of into a dark place mentally," Gaga says. "Maybe I scared myself a little bit. For weeks, I was really bothered. It was in my head a lot. I was actually trying to figure out what I was trying to say. There's a side of me that's scared of another side. And I think that there was a sense in me that I was not done healing." Starting with her Coachella performance in April, essentially the first draft of the show, Gaga placed that internal battle at the center of her performance. She says, "I decided I wanted to make it something that everybody could understand and love, and it didn't have to be the most dark thing that I'd ever created. Is that mayhem talking? I have to be dark. And like, what is it that in me that I have to be the toughest or the most edgy?" Gaga laughs when I point out that, lightened up or not, she chose to put a concept she found psychologically destabilizing at the center of a world tour, forcing herself to revisit it night after night. "You just pretty much nailed me and psychoanalyzed me all at once," Gaga says. "That's very something that I would do, is have like a traumatic experience and then orbit everything around it." But as she sees it, discomfort in all the areas of life can make you better. You just have to allow yourself to work through it. The disease video reaches a new height of horror towards the end when Mayhem, masked and in bondage gear, retches up a large quantity of black bile. Shortly afterward, the scenario shifts and Ethereal Gaga wraps her foe in an embrace, singing the chorus to the monster, "I can cure your disease." The imagery feels like a reference to a key moment in Gaga's career when the art pop backlash crystallized. As she sang her song, "Swine," at South by Southwest in March 2014, Gaga had a performance artist named Millie Brown vomit dyed milk on her body. It didn't go over well. Much debate ensued about glamorizing bulimia, and the stunt helped cement a perception that Gaga was allowing her penchant for spectacle and what detractors assumed was a desire to shock, overwhelm her music. She tried to explain that the song "You're Just a Pig in a Human Body" and performance were an attempt to process her sexual assault and anything but a random provocation. No one seemed to be listening, and the overall rejection of art pop altered the course of Gaga's career. "Yeah, very impactful," Gaga says. "Like, much more impactful than any other criticism for any artwork. That was hard. That was the first time I ever had major criticism about a piece of work that I had made." In early October, on a brief break from the tour, Gaga is back where Mayhem began. She's perched on a black leather chair in a tranquil live room in Los Angeles's The Village studio. Today's outfit is an oversized black blazer over a Social Distortion t-shirt and knee-high leather boots with 3-inch heels. She's getting over a cold, but her eyes are bright. The tour is, for once, living up to her vision for it, and she just won Artist of the Year at the VMAs. "I've played a lot of shows," she says. "I feel pretty good." Sometime in 2023, Gaga sat at the Steinway piano in the corner of this very room and began to write what became the first track recording for Mayhem, the swaggering love song "Vanish Into You" with producer Andrew Watt. They met in another studio a few months earlier when Watt was working on the Rolling Stones Grammy-winning Hackney Diamonds. She was nearby, recording some Joker-related music, and Mick Jagger invited her in while they were laying down an unusually strong gospel-y ballad, "Sweet Sounds of Heaven," with Stevie Wonder sitting in on keyboards, no less. Watt summoned the nerve to put a microphone in her hand, and within minutes, the song became a duet. She came into the live room, says Watt, and it was the first time I ever got to witness in person, besides seeing her concerts, the absolute fearlessness that she has. Yes, she's Lady fucking Gaga, but they're the Rolling fucking Stones, you know, and Stevie fucking Wonder. It's a song she only heard twice. Mick hands her the lyrics, and then she just starts vibing off of them. Gaga and Michael Polanski stayed in touch with Watt and brought him in when she felt ready to begin recording her own album. The trio ended up executive producing it together. As Vanish Into You developed, Watt suggested adding the producer drum programmer, Sir Cut, to the process. And they all began a year of close collaboration. In the process, Gaga finally stirred back into the center of her artistic lane after years of productive detours that she traces directly to the art pop aftermath. I put so much into art pop, Gaga says. It really was my EDM opus. And also, I was in a very chaotic place. It feels hard sometimes to stand firmly in the ground when it's sinking, you know. The album and her choices around it refuse to give people what they expected. People don't like it if I say, I won't dress the way you want me to dress, I won't have the hair you want me to have, and I'm going to not make pop music the way you want me to make it, because you want everything to sound like Bad Romance, and I'm never doing that again. The sexism within that response is, in hindsight, obvious to Lady Gaga. When male artists refuse to repeat themselves, she points out, they're celebrated as visionaries, radical thinkers discovering new territory, who don't need to adhere to the laurels of their previous success. Instead, I was sort of heralded as, like, over. She was at that time all of 27 years. In her mind, the world was treating her life like a product, not an artist. It was every angle and every room, every place I went to, she says. Product, object, business. What can you get her to do? Will she do this? Can you get her to do this? Once I became a huge business for people, their priority was not making sure that I had a dignified artistic experience. It was to make sure that I could earn money as fast as possible. There came a time in my life where I would enter rooms and there were no instruments anymore. It was about trying to control me to be a piece of a business. So she simply slipped out of that world, gliding into ancillary departments with some initial help from the likes of Tony Bennett and Bradley Cooper. Part of the way I've taken myself out of the conversation so when it's difficult, she says, is by paving my own path. I kept creating spaces where I could be in control. Maybe if I do this, I won't be an object. And as she sees it, she needed all those detours. Mayhem, as a piece of music, I never would have made it without the 10 years of experience that I had, she says. Nearly 30, if you count all my years of music. What would Mayhem sound like if I hadn't become a jazz singer? What would it have sounded like if I hadn't made art pop? 2020's Chromatica, her first attempt at a return to pop, had some generally great songs, including 9/11, a brazenly direct reference to the antipsychotics she was taking. She since cut down on her meds. I'm on some, yeah, but not as many. I weaned off a lot of them. She still loves that album, but now sees it as sort of a half measure, a transitional moment. Chromatica was very literal because that's all I had, she says. I didn't have a lot of the same type of poetry inside of me because I had sort of lost it. And I actually think that was true for the album Joanne as well. But it's almost like if someone were to say, how do you feel? And you refuse to give an artistic response, you just go, I feel like shit. The spirit of Chromatica was to be hopeful when you're not. Mayhem comes from a very different Gaga. I was willingly and openly running through all the nightmares of my past and my present and just finding poetry in all of it, she says. And that was a sign of my health as a musician. One of the things I'm most grateful for is gaining all of my artistic faculties back to make this record. I had to dig very, very deep, and I had to change a lot of my life and re-enter and recenter around what I needed as a human being. One day in 2024, her fiancé, Michael Polansky, proposed marriage by wrapping a strand of grass around Gaga's finger in their backyard, as she recounted in her song, Blade of Grass. At some point, though, he upgraded. In the LA studio, there's a diamond nearly the size of a newborn's fist on Gaga's ring finger. I have the blade of grass, she promises. I'm just not wearing it today. When he happened to meet Gaga's mom at a fundraiser in late 2019, Polansky never imagined marrying or even going on a single date with a pop star. When her mom first started telling me she wanted to set me up with her daughter, says Polansky, who grew up in Minnesota, I thought she had to have been joking because nobody in my life would have thought of me as somebody who wanted to get attention. A lyric Gaga wrote about him addressed that incongruity. How does a man like me love a woman like you? Or as Polansky puts it, how could somebody who is so shy and wants so much privacy, someone that would cause his life to become the exact opposite of everything he thought he wanted? To make it all make sense, he too would have to evolve. My mom thought we would be a good match, Gaga says, or that at least I would be enamored with him. Her mother made a point of adding, Stephanie, he's a very serious guy. Telling this story now, Gaga can't quite get the words out. She chokes up and begins to weep. Sorry, she says. It's so special to look back on that because so many people in my life at that time were looking for a good time. People really loved drunk Lady Gaga. She knew that with Polansky, none of my tricks were going to work on him. We're going to meet each other and probably have a very sincere adult conversation and see if we liked each other. Michael's sense of gravity might be the thing that I was attracted to about him the most. He immediately understood how serious things were for me. In the past, she acknowledges daddy issues led her to some bad choices in men. My dad's kind of a tough guy, she said. When I first met him, he poked me in the chest and said of my impending article in Rolling Stone, keep it clean. My dad was more how I was, the live fast, die young mentality. He's reformed now. He's changed a lot. So I think I was attracted to that when I was younger. But this was very different. As Gaga's new relationship deepened, in fact, she thinks of her father felt relief for the first time since he saw her set a club stage on fire with hairspray as a teenager. I think he was always really worried about me, Gaga says. He doesn't feel like he has to worry about me anymore, which is a nice feeling to know my dad can have some rest with that. They're close despite political differences. Her dad is an outspoken conservative and Trump supporter, and Gaga is a longtime Democrat who sang the national anthem at Joe Biden's presidential inauguration. I just try to focus on my relationship with my dad outside of what we don't agree about, she says, and everyone knows that is hard. We're a family, just like all families. When she met Michael Polansky, she was finishing Chromatica, an album purportedly about healing. She was actually in rough shape. I was smoking 3 packs of cigarettes, sitting on the porch all day, she says. She was about to do Chromatica interviews explaining what a great place she was in, but in reality, I was as great as I could be for someone that smoked 3 packs of cigarettes all day, smoked weed all day, knocked back a couple bottles of wine, and passed out. The more dramatic crises of 2017 or so had passed, but even by the time she shot House of Gucci in early 2021, she was feeling unstable. Her references at that time to a psychiatric nurse on the set had less to do with the rigors of the role than her ongoing issues. "I don't think I was doing very well during that film at all," she says. COVID-19 hit just weeks after the couple met. She put Chromatica out early, but had to cancel every touring plan and performance plan, Michael Polonsky recalls. "So I actually got her as Stephanie from the very beginning. But what Polonsky saw in her when they met worried him. The piece that I always noticed was how disempowered she felt," he says, "not in charge of her own life. I've never met somebody so incredibly talented and gifted feel so disempowered." He watched her sit down at the piano to write and start crying. And that ends the feature article on Lady Gaga in the December 2025 edition of Rolling Stone. It will continue next week with more. This is Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thank you for listening.